That's possible, she thought. But why would he do that? The big guy Jamie is referring to clearly is not Alan. But who is it? If Jamie talks about the big guy to the detective, and Jamie tells him Jack used to call him the big guy, they might assume he was talking about himself. I can only imagine how the Crowleys are feeling right now. How would I feel if Jamie got arrested? He'd be so frightened. I don't know what to do. I just don't know what to do.
39. Detective Mike Wilson had not been able to put his mind at rest. He was deeply distressed that he had not been able to tie up a troubling loose end in the investigation. He had virtually no information that would lead them to the man who had sold Carrie the beer and then tried to force himself on her. According to Carrie's friend who had told him about the incident, he had suggested meeting Carrie at her house after the party was over. Suppose he had come over after Alan left. He had already been aggressive with Carrie. If she refused him again, might he have become violent? There was one way they might possibly get a lead on him. The next day, Mike called Aline at work.
Aline, even though Alan has been charged, I still need to do a few things to complete the investigation, and you might be able to help me.
Of course, Aline said.
I'd like to meet and talk to you quietly for a few minutes.
Sure. Do you want to come to the house?
No. This is a conversation I would rather have with you alone.
When do you have in mind?
By any chance, are you free tonight?
Yes, I am.
I'd like to get a little away from Saddle River, where we both could be recognized.
They agreed to meet at a diner on Old Hook Road in Westwood. When Aline arrived promptly at 5:30, Mike waved to her from the corner booth. She slid in opposite him.
After I spoke to you, it occurred to me that you'd probably prefer to go to a place for a glass of wine versus a cup of coffee, he said.
To be honest, that would have been my first choice. As it is, I drink too much coffee. Mike smiled.
Aline, the next building over is an Irish pub that just opened. We wouldn't even have to move our cars. Do you want to walk over there?
Sounds great to me. 5 minutes later, they were sitting in O'Malley's, at a table in the corner of the bar. Aline took her first sip of Pinot Grigio while Mike took a drink from his beer.
Aline, I know how strongly your mother feels about Alan Crowley's guilt, which is why I don't want to have this discussion in her presence. I do believe that he did it, but there are two loose ends that I wish I could clear up. The first is to find whoever helped Carrie with the tire.
Is there any way I can help you with that?
7 girls who were at the party are still seniors at the high school. They're minors. These parents refuse to allow them to talk to me. In your work as a guidance counselor, I assume you're going to interact with some of these girls.
At some point, I probably will.
It makes sense that they might want to talk to you about Carrie.
Possibly.
Carrie told one girl about the guy who helped her with the tire. She might have told some of these girls as well. If they talk to you about Carrie, could you somehow work that into the conversation?
Aline exhaled. You must know I'm on really shaky ethical ground here. The privacy rules for guidance counselors are very strict.
I understand that. I'm not looking for personal information on these girls. Maybe I don't even have to know the name of the girl who shares something with you. But if any of them knows something that will lead me to that guy, it will be enormously helpful. If I give you a list of their names, could you get them to talk about Carrie and bring up the subject of the guy who helped her with the tire?
Aline considered for a minute. Once again, she knew that she would be taking a chance on losing her job. On the other hand, she had seen the disbelieving look on Alan Crowley's face when he had been photographed, leaving the courtroom in prison clothes and handcuffs. If there was even the slightest chance that he was innocent.
I'll do it, she said firmly.
Mike's serious expression brightened.
Thank you. It's a lead that may not go anywhere, but I need to follow it through.
He picked up the stein of beer on the table in front of him.
A glass of beer hits the spot at the end of the day, he said.
And so does a glass of wine. He leaned his glass forward.
A toast to that.
They clinked glasses.
You said there was something else you wanted to talk to me about?
Aline's tone of voice was more of a question.
It may be nothing, but that last text Carrie sent you the day of the party sticks in my mind. You had said she was something of a drama queen, but I wonder if you've had any ideas about what she might have been referring to.
I've asked myself the same thing over and over, Aline said slowly. The answer is no. Carrie would write something like, got A's in two classes, celebrating that our team won 3 games in a row. But never anything like something very important to talk to you about.
Aline, from my interviews, I have learned that Carrie and Alan would break up and then get back together the next day. Do you think there's any chance that the text was referring to him?
Aline shook her head. The answer is, I simply don't know.
I thought you'd say that.
Mike took a sip from the beer.
What I'm asking you to do is to encourage those girls to talk to you about Carrie. Ask if she told any of them what was so very important.
This time, Aline did not hesitate.
Yes to that request, too.
Then we're on the same page.
Mike paused, then added,
I'm getting hungry. Any chance you might stay for dinner? I just came upon this place last month. Wherever they found the chef, he's excellent.
That's the second dinner invitation in a few days, Aline thought.
Her parents were having dinner with friends at the club.
Why not? Aline asked herself.
I hope they have corned beef and cabbage, she told Mike.
That's a must when you're an Irish pub. I had it last week. It's really good.
You've convinced me.
The dinner was as good as Mike had promised. They compared their backgrounds. Aline said,
I went to Columbia. I always thought I would be a social worker or a teacher. But when I was studying for my master's, I decided that being a guidance counselor would be the right fit for me. I really enjoy helping the kids with their choices.
I'm a local guy, too. I grew up in Washington Township, played football at St. Joe's in Montvale, and went to Michigan. No, I didn't play football there.
Are your parents, family, still in Washington Township?
I'm an only child, and no, right after I graduated high school, my parents moved to New York City. Dad walks to his law office, and Mom loves being closer to the arts.
And what did you do after you finished Michigan?
After I graduated, I realized I wanted to work in criminal justice. I got a master's at John Jay in Manhattan. I was on the police force in Waldwick for a couple years before I got the position in the prosecutor's office. This past June, I finished a grueling 4 years of going to Seton Hall Law School at night.
You sound very ambitious. What are you going to do with your law degree?
The first thing I'm going to do is try to pass the bar exam. After that, I'm not sure. But if I want to move up the ladder in police work, having a law degree will be very helpful.
Have you worked with families like mine? Where a family member was murdered?
In the 6 years I've been at the prosecutor's office, unfortunately, many times.
As a guidance counselor, I'm supposed to be a bit of an expert on coping strategies. I know how bad it is for me, but I can see that my father and mother are torn apart. I wonder if anything will ever bring them peace.
When the trial is over and justice has been served, that's when the real healing will start.
I hope so. Aline said. They certainly helped me when I was going through hell.
At the query on Mike's face, she told him about losing Rick to a drunk driver.
What happened to the driver who killed him?
He was found not guilty because a friend lied for him. Nobody saw the accident. We really believe that his passenger, who was his friend and who hadn't been drinking, switched places with him before the police arrived. Other witnesses who were at the party said that when he left, and this was just a few minutes before the accident, he had been drinking heavily and he had been driving. And it was his car. But I guess the jury just wasn't sure and they let him off.
Sometimes those things happen.
Aline hesitated and then said, her voice quivering,
Right now he's married, has 2 kids and a good job on Wall Street, and is living happily ever after.
How have you been able to cope with that? Mike asked gently.
At first I was terribly angry and resentful. That was why I took the job in London at the international school. I wanted to get away. For a long time, I was completely bitter. But one day I woke up and realized I was ruining my life by not accepting what happened. And then I realized my being angry and bitter wasn't going to change anything. As hard and unfair as things can be, I had to move on or else I'd go crazy.
I'm glad you made that choice. I'm sure that's what your fiancé would have wanted you to do.
I agree.
For a moment, Aline was lost in thought. Then her expression brightened.
I just realized something. I was sure you looked familiar the first time I saw you at my parents' house. In my freshman year in high school, my girlfriends and I went to see the spring play at St. Joe's. They were doing West Side Story. By any chance, were you in it?
I've just met a girl named Maria, Mike began to sing softly.
It was you. I love that song. You were so good. I'm a pretty good soprano. I'd sing it along with you, but I don't want us to get thrown out of the bar.
If they don't like that one, we could do Danny Boy instead.
Aline laughed, a genuine laugh. It made her realize it was the first time she had felt really good in a long time.
The morning after his arraignment, Alan woke up groggy with sleep. He had had a vivid dream involving Carrie and the last minutes he was with her. For a moment, he had hesitated after he walked around the house. Kissing her goodbye. The funeral. Carrie asking him,
Alan, why are you wearing handcuffs?
Reporters. Questions shouted at him. When he opened his eyes, it was 7:45. As his brain cleared, the reality of what had happened leapt into his mind.
What will happen next? I'm supposed to go to Princeton tomorrow.
He looked across the room at his half-packed suitcase.
Will I be able to finish packing?
He wondered as he headed for the shower. When he went downstairs, his mother and father were sitting at the kitchen table having coffee. They both looked as though they'd had a lousy night's sleep.
Worrying about me, of course.
He thought bitterly. His father's laptop was open in front of him. Looking up from the computer, he greeted him with a question.
Alan, have you checked your email this morning?
No, why?
His mother and father looked at each other. She said, Alan, your father and I received an email from Princeton. You were copied on it. It was from the Dean of Admissions. They urgently need to schedule a teleconference with the three of us today.
Today? Alan said. So that means they want to talk to us before we drive down there tomorrow. They're probably going to say they changed their minds and are rejecting me.
Alan, his father said, let's not get ahead of ourselves. I replied that we will speak to them at 9 this morning.
Should we ask Lester Parker if he should be on the call? June asked.
Let's see what they have to say before we start getting lawyers involved, Doug said.
Alan was sure he would not be driving to Princeton tomorrow. He did not voice that to his mother or father, although he could tell from their faces that that was what they thought, too. He remembered how they had hammered into him the need to have good marks, all because they believed graduating from an Ivy League school sets you up for life. Now Princeton is going to tell him to stay home. His mother suggested making him French toast, his favorite. Her tone reminded him of the time she offered him ice cream after he had his tonsils out. Despite everything, he was hungry.
Okay, thanks, he said.
They had breakfast in complete silence. At 1 minute before 9, his father dialed into the teleconference number provided in the email. He put the phone on speaker. David Willis introduced himself as Princeton's Director of Admissions.
I also have on the call with me Lawrence Knowles, Chief Counsel to Princeton University.
Perfunctory greetings were exchanged before Willis came to the point.
Alan, we are aware of the unfortunate circumstances in which you find yourself. We have come to the conclusion that it would be in the best interest of all parties if you were to defer enrollment until your personal situation is satisfactorily resolved.
June said,
But we are planning to drive him for freshman registration tomorrow.
I know that, Mrs. Crowley. That is why we are speaking today.
Doug jumped in.
You said if you were to defer enrollment. Is this Alan's choice, or are you telling us this is what he has to do? I'm sorry if I was not clear. It would be awkward, under the present circumstances, for Alan to take his place in the freshman class.
What is that supposed to mean?
June demanded. This time it was the attorney who responded.
It means when all of the charges against Alan have been dismissed, he can apply for readmission.
I told you we should have had Lester Parker on this call,
June interrupted, glaring at Doug.
We will refund to you the money you have sent to date, Willis added.
Alan asked,
How did you find out about what happened to me?
Lawrence Knowles answered,
We make an effort to keep track of our incoming freshmen, but I will not answer more specifically than that.
When the call ended, Knowles dialed Willis, who picked up immediately. He said,
David, I guess that went as well as could be expected.
Do you think they'll challenge our decision?
I doubt it. Any lawyer who reviews our terms of acceptance will see that our moral turpitude clause gives us wide latitude regarding whom we allow to enroll. By the way, Willis added, our news monitoring service appears to have worked. I got an email from the PR firm this morning. They attached the article from a northern New Jersey paper about Princeton-bound Alan Crowley being arrested for murder.
Well, that's reassuring that they picked it up.
Knowles said.
Yes, it is,
Willis agreed. In this case, the monitoring service had not been necessary. Two calls about Alan Crowley had already been made to the university's Office of Admissions. The first was polite, almost apologetic. The second was a very angry caller who questioned the type of student Princeton was admitting nowadays. 41. As the days passed, Marge became more and more concerned about Jamie. Usually sunny in the morning and looking forward to going to work, he had become very silent. In her attempts at conversation, he invariably brought up Carrie's name.
Carrie's in heaven with Daddy. I want to go there too.
You will someday, but not for a long time. I need you here with me, Jamie.
You can come up with us, too.
Another time out of the blue, he asked,
In heaven? Do people go swimming like Carrie did?
Maybe. Dear God, please don't let him keep bringing up Carrie's name,
Marge begged. She tried to change the subject.
Now that football has started again, are you looking forward to going and watching the practices?
They're big guys, too.
Does anyone call you big guy, Jamie?
Daddy did.
I know. Anybody else?
Jamie smiled.
I call myself the big guy.
Despairing, Marge thought, it's only a matter of time before he talks to somebody and gets himself in trouble.
42. Aline began to fall into the welcome pattern of busy days at school. True to her promise to Mike, she tried to make a point of meeting the seven girls who had been at the party, but had not spoken to the police. She was making slow progress before help came from an unexpected source, Pat Tarleton, who stopped into her office one morning.
Good morning, Aline. How are things at home?
Aline sighed.
Okay, I guess. Anything wrong?
Pat asked.
Last night at dinner, my mother and I got into a...
She paused.
Let's say we had a frank exchange of viewpoints.
Uh-oh.
About what?
Mom told us that she called Princeton to give them a piece of her mind and let them know what she thought of the type of students they are admitting. Of course, she was referring to Alan Crowley. I told her I thought that she was wrong. He has only been accused of a crime. He hasn't been convicted. I told her she should stay out of it. Needless to say, she strongly disagreed.
Oh, Aline, I'm sorry.
It's all right, Pat. We're back on speaking terms.
No, Aline. I'm sorry I didn't tell you I called Princeton to make sure they knew about Alan's arrest.
Pat, I don't understand. Why would you...
Because, Aline, I have a duty to this school and our current and future students. Every parent in this town is hoping their son or daughter will be accepted by Ivy League schools or the Notre Dames and Georgetowns. As you well know, the competition to get into these places is fierce. It is essential that Saddle River High maintain a good relationship with them, including Princeton. If we didn't give them a heads up that one of our students, who was headed their way, was going to cause them bad publicity, they could make it that much tougher for future students who apply to their school.
She paused.
I didn't like making that call, but I had to do it. And if I had told you, I could have spared you an argument with your mother.
I never thought of it that way, Pat. I guess I still have a lot to learn.
You're doing fine, Pat said. And now let me get to the reason why I dropped by. Aline, I have a favor to ask, and I promise I'll understand if you say no. A lot of the girls who were on the lacrosse team this spring with Carrie graduated and have left for college. But last year's juniors, who are seniors now, are still coping with what happened to her. I believe it would be very helpful if they had a chance to share with you their feelings about Carrie. I'd like you to be the guidance counselor for these girls. Now, I understand if...
Aline cut her off.
Pat, it's okay. It will be therapeutic for me, too, to hear about Carrie through the eyes of her friends. I'd love to work with them.
Pat left the office, promising to email the names. Aline experienced a tremendous sense of relief. She didn't have to invent a reason to spend time alone with these girls. Pat had given her one. Before the first period bell rang, she stopped into the teacher's lounge for a second cup of coffee. Several teachers were there, including Scott Kimball, who was talking to a very attractive history teacher who was new to the area. She was looking at him admiringly. I have to admit, Aline thought, he is a good-looking man. She guessed the new teacher, Barbara Bagley, to be about 30, and that she was very interested in Scott. Her suspicions were confirmed when Barbara told Scott,
My parents are going to be visiting next week from Cleveland, and they love to go out to nice restaurants. Where would you recommend?
Waving Aline over to join them, he said,
Aline and I had a great dinner at the French restaurant La Petite in Nyack last week. Aline, wasn't it terrific?
Aline had assumed, incorrectly, that Scott would be discreet about their having spent an evening together. She looked around to see if any of the other teachers were privy to their conversation. She didn't think so. She tried to conceal her irritation as she answered,
La Petite is wonderful. I'm sure you and your parents will enjoy it, Barbara.
Aline walked over to the coffee machine to avoid further small talk. As she poured a cup for herself, she thought, That is the last time I will socialize with Scott Kimball outside of school and give him the chance to embarrass me. 43. Alan lived through the next week in a daze. He remembered unpacking his suitcase, hanging up some clothes and putting the rest in the dresser.
Mom made sure I was neat, he thought. She'd give me a smack if I left clothes on the floor.
He didn't know what to do with himself. His father suggested that he try to find a temporary job.
Temporary?
He asked himself.
How long is that? Until I go to trial and get convicted of murder?
Carrie's face was always in his mind. The fun things they had done together kept jumping back into his memory. The senior prom last May. The ride down to the shore afterward. Even though it was very late, they both got up early and took a walk on the beach. Again, he could feel the warmth of the sand under his bare feet and hear Carrie's voice.
Alan, you were the best-looking guy at the prom. I'm so happy you let me pick your tux. It was perfect.
And I was also the luckiest guy at the prom because I was with the most beautiful girl in the room.
Every day after breakfast, he had driven to visit her grave. He stopped after noticing someone taking his picture next to the Dowling Monument. The next day, it had appeared on the front page of the Record newspaper. Before he was arrested, he had always had a good appetite. Now it felt as if anything he ate stuck in his throat. His mother's constant reminders to eat made him feel even more stressed. Finally, he burst out,
Mom, are you trying to fatten me up for my trial to show what good care you're taking of me?
Alan, these outbursts of yours are the kind of thing you pulled when you were a child. I didn't tolerate them then, and I'm not going to tolerate it now. I can understand that you are upset, but so are your father and I. We're not taking our anxiety out on you. Don't take yours out on us.
Right to the end,
Alan thought.
Mom will run her tight ship.
As usual, she had the last word.
And don't forget, the only reason you are in this situation is because of your temper. If you hadn't quarreled with Carrie and had just told the truth, you'd be at Princeton right now.
After that exchange, Alan vowed to say as little as possible to either of his parents. Unable to sleep at night, he slept most of the day. His mother went back to her job as a critical care nurse at Englewood Hospital. His father had only taken 2 days off at the time of his arrest. He was back to catching the 7:14 a.m. train to the city. The only one whose company he looked forward to was Brenda, their longtime housekeeper. Her sympathy and concern for him was a welcome change from his parents. One afternoon, after fixing him some pancakes, Brenda said,
"Alan, I know there's no way in the world you hurt that poor girl. Everything is going to be okay for you. I can feel it in my bones, and my bones never lie."
A ghost of a smile came over Alan's face.
"Take care of those bones, Brenda. They're the only things that believe in me."
By now, all of his friends had left for their colleges. He had not heard from any of them. The several texts and emails he sent received no response. He could understand why Rich, Stan, and Bobby were angry at him. But why had his other friends dropped him? Did he really have to ask? The sense of isolation was suffocating. His father was right when he said he should try to get a job. But on a job application, they ask if you have ever been arrested.
How should I answer? "Yes, I'm charged with murder and I'm wearing an ankle bracelet, but don't worry, I didn't do it."
After sleeping a good part of the day, Alan began to take long walks at night. He would drive to a walking trail and, carrying only a flashlight, he would take comfort in the solitude and quiet of the woods.
44. Seven players from last year's lacrosse team were still students at the high school. Thanks to Pat Tarleton's administrative assistance, Aline's counseling appointments with each of them were spaced far enough apart that no one had any suspicion about why she had been assigned to Aline. With each session, she began by saying,
"I know you played lacrosse with my sister Carrie. I wonder if you would like to talk about how you felt about her and how you're feeling now."
As she expected, there was a pattern to the answers.
"I miss Carrie so much. I can't believe that anyone would deliberately hurt her.
The party was so much fun, but then Carrie and Alan had the fight."
Did the fight spoil the party?
"Oh no, Carrie, as usual, just laughed it off. But I know they were texting back and forth after he left."
Does anyone think that she should have broken up with him?
"Only Annie. But you know why? She had a big crush on Alan."
When she broached the subject of who had brought the beer to the party, their answers were for the most part the same.
"Some of the guys brought it. Carrie had some there."
Only one girl, Alexis, when asked about the beer, hesitated for a long minute before she said,
"I have no idea."
Aline was sure she was holding back, but did not press her. She asked the girls if they had been with Carrie the day of the party. Four of them had been swimming in the pool with her from noon until 3 o'clock. "Was anyone else there?" Aline asked. Alexis said,
"When Jamie Chapman came home from work, he yelled over to Carrie to ask if he could come swimming too."
"What did Carrie say?"
"Carrie liked Jamie. She told him to come over. Then he heard us talking about who was coming to the party. He asked Carrie if he could come. She told him it was only for kids who were still at the high school."
How did he respond to that?
"He looked really disappointed. And when he left, Carrie said, 'I feel bad turning him down, but we're having drinks at the party. He might talk about that to other people.'"
Aline decided to be candid with her next question. "The police believe that the guy who got Carrie the beer for her party had an argument with her. He's the one who recently helped her change a flat tire. They want to find that guy and talk to him. Did Carrie ever mention him to you?" The only one who knew about the flat tire was Sinead Gilmartin.
"Carrie told me she had a flat on Route 17, and she wasn't going to tell her father because he'd been after her to replace a bald tire."
"Do you know how long before the party that happened?"
"I guess about a week. Maybe a little more."
Sinead, do you recall anything Carrie told you that might help the police find this guy? What he looked like? The kind of car he was driving?
I think I remember. The guy who pulled over, Carrie said, was driving a tow truck. That's why he was able to change it so fast. She tried to give him a $10 tip, but he turned it down. She said he was really nice.
It was information Mike would want to know immediately. As soon as Sinead left her office, Aline started typing an email to him, but then stopped. Don't send this through the school computer system, she thought. She took out her phone and sent Mike a text. When Mike read the text from Aline, he seized on the words, tow truck. Although the information was still very general, it gave them more to work with than just some guy who was about 25 had stopped to help Carrie. From his time on the Waldwick Police Force, he knew how most traffic safety units in Bergen County regulated their highways and roads. They had township traffic safety units that oversaw crossing guards and traffic lights. These units also maintained the list of tow truck operators who had a permit to work in their town. Waldwick, he recalled, had about a dozen companies with permits. He assumed Saddle River and the neighboring towns, Washington Township, Upper Saddle River, Woodcliff Lake, Hohokus, had a similar number. There was no guarantee, however, that the tow truck he was interested in was on the permit list in a local town. Route 17 was a major highway serving northern New Jersey. Going 5 miles up or down the highway from Saddle River would bring in more towns and dozens more companies. But they had to start somewhere. Mike assigned Sam Hines, a young investigator in his office, the task of tracking down each town's roster of companies with tow truck permits and contacting the companies to ask about their drivers who were under 30 years old.
Mike, this is going to take a really long time, Sam said.
I know. That's why I suggest you begin immediately.
The last student Pat Tarleton had suggested Aline work with was Valerie Long. Because she was a junior, the discussion of college choices could wait. It was one of the economics teachers who brought matters to a head by stopping by Aline's office and telling her that Valerie was totally indifferent in class and seemed to be almost in a trance. Maybe if you talk to her, you can find out what the problem is, the teacher said. The next day, Aline scheduled a meeting with Valerie. When the girl came into her office, the sad expression on her face and in her eyes was clearly visible. Aline wondered if grief over Carrie's death might be the cause of her malaise. She decided to go directly to that subject. After Valerie took a chair opposite hers, Aline said, Valerie, I know many of the girls are very upset by Carrie's death, and I hear that you were very close to her.
I loved Carrie. She was my best friend in school.
Then I can understand why you feel so bad about her death.
No, you can't.
Aline paused, hoping Valerie would say more. But when she didn't, Aline knew that there was no point in pressing her. Instead, she said, Valerie, I reviewed your records. Your marks at your former school were very good. They were strong after you arrived here last January. But then they fell off considerably. And this year, your teachers are concerned that you seem distracted in class.
I am distracted, Valerie thought, but I can't tell why.
Instead, she said,
I miss my friends in Chicago. They're all there. My stepfather changed jobs, and overnight they told me we were moving. I wanted to live with my grandmother in Chicago and stay in my former school, but they wouldn't let me.
What about your biological father? Aline asked. Valerie smiled spontaneously.
He was wonderful. I was Daddy's little girl. He found out he had brain cancer and was dead in 2 months.
How old were you when that happened?
He died on my 8th birthday.
I'm so sorry. I'm sure that was very difficult for you.
Whatever. My mother knows better than to have a celebration on my birthday. She remarried 2 years ago. Wayne, she said derisively, is 20 years older than my mother.
There are multiple reasons Valerie is floundering, Aline thought. She misses her Chicago friends. She lost Carrie, her only friend here. She's still grieving for her natural father, and she resents her stepfather. Aline decided that the next thing to do was to arrange a meeting with both of Valerie's parents and discuss with them Valerie's obvious resentment about the move, and if that might be a factor in her lack of interest in her schoolwork.
"Valerie," she said, "as you know, Carrie was my sister. I, of all people, can understand how sad you are to lose her. It's hard to make friends in a new environment, especially when all the other students have known each other for a long time. I can only imagine how difficult it was for you to lose your best friend."
"You have no idea how difficult it was," Valerie said.
"Valerie, I know that Carrie would want you to make new friends and keep up with your schoolwork."
"I'll try,"
Valerie said indifferently. Then as she looked into Aline's face and saw the sadness in her eyes, she wondered if someday she could tell Aline what was really going on.
46. June Crowley went to Mass every Sunday, but she was a practicing Catholic in the loosest definition of the phrase. It was just as important to her to be beautifully dressed as it was to attend the sacraments. Over the years, it had never occurred to her to have a private conversation with Father Frank. But now, because she was frantic with worry about Alan, she decided to have a talk with him. She called and asked if she could meet with him as soon as possible. He suggested that the next morning would be a good time for him. When she arrived at his office, she was still framing in her mind how to tell him about her concerns. But when she was there, she simply blurted out the words.
"Father, I'm desperately worried that Alan may be suicidal."
Father Frank was well aware that Alan Crowley had been arrested. He had been thinking of calling June and Doug to tell them how sorry he was for both them and Alan. Now he was deeply concerned that June might be right.
"What makes you think that, June?"
he asked.
"It's the way he's acting. He sleeps most of the day and then takes off right after dinner. I don't know where he goes or if he's even talking to anyone, and I doubt that. He swears that he was not the one who hurt Carrie, but he knows that everyone believes he did it, and everybody expects that when he goes on trial, he'll be found guilty and sent to prison for many years."
"June, you're a nurse. Do you know any psychiatrists who could talk to him?"
"I've suggested that to him. He flat out refuses to go."
"Do you think it would help if I had a talk with him?"
"It would be a great relief to me if you did."
"It will be better if I can catch him alone. Are you and Doug working tomorrow afternoon?"
"Yes, we are."
"Okay. I'll drop by in the late afternoon and see if I can get him to speak to me."
"Our housekeeper, Brenda, will be there. I'll tell her to let you in."
The next afternoon, Father Frank drove to the Crowley home and rang the bell. It was answered immediately by a middle-aged woman he assumed was the housekeeper.
"You must be Brenda," he said. "I'm Father Frank."
"Mrs. Crowley told me you would be stopping by," Brenda replied.
"Is Alan home?"
"Yes, he's in the den watching TV. Should I tell him you're here?"
"No, just show me the den and I'll take it from there."
"Can I get you anything to drink?"
"No, thank you. I'm fine."
As Father Frank stood at the door of the TV room, Brenda made a noisy retreat in the direction of the kitchen. Alan was watching a movie. He didn't look up when the priest opened the door and walked into the room. Father Frank barely recognized Alan, whose appearance was quite different from the well-groomed young man he often saw in church. He was wearing an old T-shirt that looked like he had slept in it, and gym shorts. A pair of scuffed sneakers was next to him on the floor. It was obvious he hadn't shaved in several days. It looked as though he hadn't bothered to comb his hair. Alan looked up. A surprised expression came over his face.
"I didn't know you were coming, Father Frank." "Your mother is very concerned about you. She believes that you're depressed."
"Wouldn't you feel depressed if you were facing a long prison term?"
"Yes, I would, Alan."
"Well, Father, don't be disappointed. If you came over to hear my confession, I'm sorry to say I didn't do it."
"Alan, I came over to talk to you and to hear what you had to say."
"Then let me say it clearly. I loved Carrie. I still love her. That night, I went over to help her clean up. She told me she was tired. We could do it in the morning. I kissed her goodnight and went home. I know I lied about that to the police and asked the guys to lie for me, but you know why I did that? I was scared. Wouldn't you be scared if suddenly everybody was looking at you like you're a killer? Do you know what it's like to have handcuffs on and be forced to wear an orange jumpsuit?
So you're telling me that you are innocent of Carrie's death?
I'm not just telling you, I'm swearing it to you. If you have a Bible with you, I'll swear on that, but it's obvious nobody believes me.
Alan, in my experience, the truth has a way of coming out. If you do go to trial, I'm sure that will be many months from now. What are you going to do between now and then?
Frankly, Father, I've been spending a lot of time thinking how nice it would be to be with Carrie again.
Alan, you're not thinking of hurting yourself, are you? Think of what that would do to your mother and father.
It would be easier for them if I just wasn't around, rather than watch me get convicted in court.
Deeply concerned, Father Frank said, "Let me remind you that it will probably be a year or more before you go to trial. By that time, your situation may have changed."
"Wouldn't that be nice?"
Alan said matter-of-factly. When Father Frank left, he was deeply disturbed remembering what Marge had told him about Jamie being in the pool, and how fearful she was that if the police found that out, they might get him to tell them that he was the one who had hit Carrie.
"What should I do? What can I do?"
He did not know that Brenda had been in the hallway catching every word, and that she couldn't wait to tell Marge all about it. 47. Brenda could barely stay near the speed limit as she drove over to Marge's house. She had called Marge to confirm she was home and that it would be okay to come over. It was obvious that Marge had seen her coming up the driveway because the door had been left open. Breathlessly, she recounted how Father Frank had dropped in to see Alan.
"He came over because June and Doug Crowley are afraid he is suicidal."
"Oh, dear God," Marge exclaimed.
"That poor boy. No wonder they're worried. He's convinced that he's going to prison for killing Carrie Dowling. He swore on the Bible that he is innocent."
"What did Father Frank say to Alan?" Marge asked anxiously.
"He was pleading with him to have faith. He told him he won't go to trial for at least a year, and a lot can happen in that time. I just pray that he convinced Alan that he shouldn't harm himself."
"I pray that too," Marge said with a tremor in her voice. Having delivered the day's gossip, Brenda looked at her watch.
"Gotta go," she said. "I have to shop for dinner."
Marge sat trembling at the thought that Alan would commit suicide. She distracted herself from that thought by turning on the 5 o'clock news. Just as she returned to her chair, Jamie came into the room. The newscast began, and Alan's picture appeared on the screen.
"That's Alan Crowley, Mom," he said excitedly.
"Yes, I know it is, Jamie." The reporter was speaking while footage of Alan at the courthouse was shown in the background.
"Rumors are swirling that Lester Parker, attorney for accused killer Alan Crowley, has approached the Bergen County prosecutor about a plea bargain. We contacted Lester Parker, and he adamantly denied that rumor."
"Why is Alan on TV?"
Jamie asked his mother.
"The police think he hurt Carrie the night she died in her pool."
"He went home."
"I know, Jamie. They think he hurt Carrie and then went home."
"No. Alan Crowley gave Carrie a hug and a kiss, and then he went home. The big guy hurt Carrie."
Aghast, Marge stared at him.
"Jamie, are you sure Alan didn't hurt Carrie and push her in the pool?"
"No, the big guy did. Alan went home. I'm hungry. What's for dinner?"
48. Aline was worried about Valerie Long. Something was not quite right about the girl, and it was more than just the loss of Carrie's friendship. The word that came to Aline's mind was despairing. In a meeting with Pat Tarleton, Aline shared with her how concerned she was about Valerie after their talk. "I think you should speak to the parents and get their version of what is going on," Pat told her. "I agree, but I have a feeling Valerie would be very unhappy if she knew I was planning to meet with her mother and stepfather. Do you think I should arrange to see them someplace outside of school?"
"No, I don't.
It's against our school's policy to have this type of meeting away from our building. It's the parents' decision to tell or not tell Valerie that they're coming in to talk to you. If she finds out they were here, they're on their own to come up with an explanation as to why. Glad to have Pat's approval, Aline looked up the contact information for Valerie's parents. She decided to start with the mother and dialed her cell phone number. It was answered on the first ring. The screen on Marina Long's phone showed that the call was from Saddle River High School. Her first words were, "Is Valerie all right?" The question made it easier for Aline to go directly to the reason for the call. "Mrs. Long, everything is okay. Valerie is in class. My name is Aline Dowling. I'm Valerie's guidance counselor at school. But I have some concerns about Valerie that I want to talk to you and your husband about."
"Aline, I'm glad you called. We have concerns too, and we're not sure what to do. Wayne and I would welcome the opportunity to meet with you."
It was agreed that the Longs would meet Aline the next day. Later that day, Aline heard a knock on her office door. When she called, "Come in," she was surprised to see Scott Kimball enter and settle into the chair opposite her. Her first thought was that she had not invited him to sit.
"Aline," he began, "I know you're annoyed at me, and you have a right to be. That was a big faux pas on my part the other day in the teacher's lounge. You had made it clear that there was to be no talk of our having socialized off-school property. As the saying goes, loose lips sink ships. I'm here to apologize."
Aline wasn't sure what to say. She had rehearsed a speech where she was going to blast him for talking about their dinner in front of another teacher. Now he had apologized and seemed genuinely contrite.
"Okay, Scott. We all make mistakes. Let's let it go." "Thanks, Aline. I really appreciate that."
He hesitated.
"Aline, I want to ask you to do something with me. It would be strictly on a professional basis. Tomorrow night at 7, there is a seminar at Montclair State about the stresses faced by high school student athletes. As a teacher and a coach, I'm obviously interested and I'm planning to go. I assume this type of presentation would be of interest to you as a guidance counselor. Would you like to go?"
Aline started to answer, but Scott kept talking.
"Just so you know, we'll be doing this as two professionals. I know better than to ask if you want to ride over with me. You don't even have to sit with me when we're there. But I warn you, I'm going to be hungry when it ends at 8:30. There's an excellent chance I'm going to ask you to join me for dinner. As professionals, of course."
Aline found herself smiling. Scott was a charmer. 3 minutes ago, he had been 100% in her doghouse. Now she found herself looking forward to spending time with him tomorrow night. "All right, Mr. Kimball," she said. "I'll meet you at the seminar. Regarding dinner afterwards, let's see what tomorrow brings."
After a sleepless night, Marge knew that she had to talk to Father Frank again. As soon as Jamie left to walk to Acme, she called him. He said,
"Marge, come to my office right now. I've been thinking a lot about our last discussion."
Marge had not expected to be invited in so quickly. She had wanted time to plan what she would say to Father Frank about what Jamie had told her. Now she only had the 10-minute car ride to the rectory to organize her thoughts. The priest answered the door himself and escorted Marge to his office. They sat in two chairs facing each other.
"Father, when Jamie and I were in the kitchen last night, Alan Crowley's picture came on the television. When I told Jamie why Alan was on TV, Jamie started talking again about what he saw the night of Carrie's party."
She hesitated.
Father Frank said, "Marge, I can see you're upset, but I think it will help if you just tell me what is worrying you."
"I know you understand that Jamie's memory can be hazy. He mixes together things that didn't happen at the same time."
"I know that, Marge,"
Father Frank said sympathetically.
"Last night, Jamie was very specific when he described what he saw happen to Carrie."
"What did he say?"
"When I explained to him that the police think Alan is the one who hurt Carrie, Jamie was sure that Alan didn't do it."
Father Frank leaned forward in his chair.
"Marge, what exactly did Jamie say?"
He told me that Alan hugged and kissed Carrie, and then he went home. Then somebody else, the big guy, hurt Carrie and pushed her in the pool.
Marge, do you think Jamie is describing what he saw accurately?
Yes, I do. But I don't know what to do.
Tears began running down Marge's cheeks. She reached over and began to fumble in her pocketbook.
Father, is there some place I could get a glass of water?
I'm sorry, Marge, Father Frank said as he headed toward the kitchen. I should have offered earlier.
When he returned with the water, he noticed how pale she looked.
Are you okay?
Marge reached for the water glass, took a sip, and swallowed a pill.
Honestly, Father, I'm having some problems with my heart. When I'm feeling stressed, like I am right now, I have to take one of these. It's a nitroglycerin pill.
Father Frank waited while she took a few more sips of water.
Oh, these pills are miraculous, she said. I feel better already.
Marge continued.
About Jamie, if what he told me is true, Alan Crowley is innocent. But how do I let Jamie talk to the police and risk having the police think Jamie hurt Carrie? I told you how Jack would call Jamie the big guy. If Jamie tells the police the big guy hurt Carrie, they might think he's talking about himself. Father, I want to help Alan Crowley, but I can't do it if it means getting Jamie in trouble.
Marge, I don't believe for a minute that Jamie was the one who hurt Carrie. I know you don't either. Wouldn't it be best to tell the police what Jamie said and just have faith in the system to work?
I don't know, Father. I just need more time to think about it.
50. Aline was about to leave her office when her cell phone rang. It was Mike Wilson.
Aline,
he asked,
could you possibly meet me tonight? There are some things I want to go over with you.
Of course.
O'Malley's at 7 o'clock?
Fine. I'll see you there. When she arrived at O'Malley's, Mike was waiting for her. He was seated at the same table in the corner they had chosen the last time.
It appears that you are a creature of habit, Aline said.
Guilty as charged, Mike replied.
My, aren't we formal?
Aline said, noting how handsome Mike looked in his jacket and tie.
Whenever I testify in court, I wear my Sunday best. I spent this afternoon getting grilled by a defense attorney.
Who won? Aline asked.
If they don't find this defendant guilty, there is no justice in the world.
The waiter approached the table. Mike asked,
Are we both creatures of habit?
Aline nodded.
A Pinot Grigio for the lady, and I'll have a Coors Light. So, Aline, how is the world of guidance?
Sometimes easy, and sometimes not.
I've got a depressed student I'm really worried about. Her parents are coming in to meet with me tomorrow. Oh, I have a potential update on Alan Crowley.
Really?
Princeton is aware of the accusations against Alan. My understanding is that in cases like these, they insist that the students stay home. She decided against sharing with him that her mother and Pat Tarleton had contacted Princeton.
I'm not surprised,
Mike said.
Colleges have media tracking services. They would have picked up reports that Princeton-bound Alan Crowley has been accused of a crime.
Mike took a long sip of his beer and then asked,
How are your parents doing?
I guess as well as can be expected. My mother is so sure that Alan is guilty. I think it's given her some peace that he's been arrested.
The families of victims often react that way. They consider it the first step toward justice. It might be a good idea for your mother to join a victim's support group. I've seen people who were helped a lot. I'll send you some information on the groups.
Thanks. I appreciate that.
Aline, let me get to the main reason I asked you to meet me tonight. As I've told you, a weakness in our case against Alan is that we haven't found the tire changer who had the incident with Carrie. The information you sent me that he was a tow truck driver is very helpful. In your text, you said one of the girls who appears to know something may be holding back. It's so important that we find this guy and confirm where he was the night of the party. Can you find a reason to spend more time with that girl and maybe get her to say more?
Aline sighed. I may be en route to a very short career as a guidance counselor if they find out what I've been doing.
Aline, I don't have to know the girl's name. I just need the information. And I promise you, nobody will know the information came from you.
In her mind, Aline relived Alexis Jacarino's distinct hesitation when she asked her about the guy who changed Carrie's tire. I'll figure out a reason to have that girl come to my office and get her talking. It was on the tip of Mike's tongue to ask Aline to stay and have dinner with him again. But if a defense attorney thought that a detective and a witness on a case were dating, he would rip both of them to shreds on cross-examination. 10 minutes later, Mike had finished his beer and Aline her wine. He signaled for the check.
Back to the office for me. I'm on the witness stand again tomorrow morning. I have to go over my reports.
And I can catch the end of dinner with my parents. I try to be around them as much as possible, and I have plans for tomorrow night. They walked to their cars. Mike was disappointed that he couldn't ask Aline to dinner. She was disappointed that he didn't. 51. Aline's call to Valerie's mother only heightened the feelings of concern she and Wayne had about Valerie. Marina was relieved when Wayne quickly agreed to work from home so that he could go with her to the high school. Hoping to avoid being seen by Valerie, they arrived at Aline's office promptly at 11 o'clock. The mother, whose resemblance to Valerie was striking, looked to be in her late 30s. The stepfather had a head full of steel-gray hair and appeared to be in his mid to late 50s. Aline's initial impression was that he reminded her of the actor Richard Gere. After introductions were completed, Marina Long asked, "Why are you worried about Valerie?" Her direct question required a direct answer. "I saw in her records that she did well at her previous high school in Chicago. But since coming here, her marks have gone down considerably. And she seems depressed," Aline told them. Marina nodded. "We know. And we've been so worried about her." Marina was obviously on the verge of tears. Aline watched as Wayne put his hand over his wife's hand. He said,
"I know I'm the major cause of the problem. From the first time she met me, she didn't like me. She thought I was trying to replace her father. I wasn't. Every effort I made to build a relationship with her was rejected. I have 2 sons who live in California. I'm a widower. My first wife and I always hoped we would have a daughter as well."
Marina added, "Valerie tries to give people the impression that he ignores his sons. The fact is, Wayne often travels to San Francisco. He always sees them when he's there. It was harder for them to come to Chicago because they both have young families. And last year, when Wayne and I went out to see them for Thanksgiving, Valerie insisted on staying home to be with her grandmother."
"Did Valerie tell you why we moved from Chicago?"
Wayne asked. "Yes, she said you were offered a better job with a bigger salary and you took it. That resulted in her being apart from her Chicago friends."
"That's not what happened," Wayne said, the frustration clear in his voice. "I am a branch manager for Merrill Lynch. The branch office I ran was shut in a consolidation. I was offered a better position in Manhattan, and I had to give them an answer right away."
Looking at his wife, he said,
"We agreed I should accept it."
Aline said, "One of the things that puzzles me is that when Valerie came to Saddle River last January, at least marks-wise, she got off to a good start. But something changed in the spring. Do you have any idea what that might have been?" Marina said, "Last May, her paternal grandmother had a stroke and passed away. Valerie had stayed very close to her after her father died." "For a young person, she has experienced a great deal of loss," Aline said. "Have you considered having her see a psychiatrist?"
"Of course we have," Marina said. "Twice I tried to introduce the idea. Both times she got furious and upset. We decided it would do more harm than good to keep bringing that up."
"As you probably know," Aline said, "my sister Carrie died 2 weeks ago." Wayne interrupted.
"We know, and we're terribly sorry. We read about it in the papers."
"Valerie told me that she considered Carrie to be her closest friend at this school,
Did she ever tell you that?
No, Marina said. I know how shocked she was when Carrie died, but I thought she